Officer John O'Keefe was found dead on Fairview Road yesterday morning in front of a friend's house. O'Keefe was a 16-year veteran of the Boston Police Department.
State prosecutors accused Karen Reed, who was O'Keefe's girlfriend, of backing into him and leaving him to die in the snow.
One of her taillights had fresh damage. She openly questioned if she hit John O'Keefe, and prosecutors say she left him a voicemail that night saying she hated him.
She denies the allegations, arguing instead she's being framed for murder.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
Reed's parents and thousands supporting her say there's so much more to this story that doesn't add up.
Her lawyers argue the police report was altered.
If you wondered what corruption looks like, that's what corruption looks like.
It's always the theories or stories that each side will put forth, right, for a jury to listen to and decide which one is more believable.
Well, we made it to the end of week one. So far, we've seen 3 days of jury selection.
The state making accusations against Reed and her attorneys of acting recklessly.
There's been a lot of criticism of the investigation after the fact, some of which I think is warranted, some of which is not.
What I've noticed is that none of the witness statements are signed.
I am never surprised when jurors are stupid enough to believe nonsense.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
Human hair, not dog hair, not turtle hair, human hair.
As far as everything that I see that's made available to me, Karen Reed is absolutely innocent.
There were 17 Ring videos deleted between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. from John O'Keefe's Ring system.
Plow driver was in fact there, never saw a body at 2:30-ish a.m.
Karen Reed is facing up to life in prison.
I'm just surprised. I'm surprised that this is going to be a battle of experts.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know.
Jury selection in the case of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus Karen Reed is officially underway. It's been more than 2 years since the death of Officer John O'Keefe, and finally, we are only days away from opening statements in a trial that is estimated to last about 2 months. It has been a long and contentious road to get us to this point. And there's still a long road ahead. The prosecution's witness list contains 87 names. Some of those included are Officer O'Keefe's brother and his niece and nephew, Brian Higgins, most of the Albert family, including Brian, Nicole, Colin, Chris, and Julie, among others, Jen, Matt, and Allison McCabe, Ryan Nagel, who pulled up behind Karen and John at Fairview that night, Lucky the snowplow driver, a Cellebrite expert, medical examiners, state police crime lab employees, 23 police officers, and more. The defense's witness list is 77 names, including some of the Alberts and McCabes, Officer O'Keefe's father, multiple forensic specialists, law enforcement officers, a representative from Google, victim witness advocate Stephen Nelson, and the Norfolk County District Attorney Michael Morrissey. You heard that right. The district attorney himself is listed on the defense's witness list. This, like everything else in this case, is highly unusual. According to a recent court filing, the prosecution states that the defense wants to have Morrissey testify about the conflict the Canton Police Department had with the investigation and the assignment of the detective unit of the Massachusetts State Police assigned to the Norfolk DA's office. The prosecution has responded, arguing that a prosecutor should only be called as a witness if their testimony is relevant, material, and not cumulative. And they say that the defense has not made a sufficient showing that it meets that standard. Generally, trial witnesses must adhere to some sort of sequestration order that prevents them from hearing testimony or arguments in a trial before they testify, since it could influence their testimony. The prosecution also argues that if Morrissey and the victim's witness advocate Stephen Nelson are called as witnesses, they couldn't be subject to any of these sequestration orders because it would limit their ability to keep tabs on the case. This, of course, would be important since Michael Morrissey is the DA, and Stephen Nelson is an employee of the DA's office who has been assigned to this case from the beginning. The prosecution argues that their observations regarding witnesses or evidence is protected as part of the prosecution's work product, though Morrissey did release that controversial video last year stating that all the witnesses have been forthcoming with law enforcement, and anything said to the contrary is a desperate attempt to reassign guilt. The final pretrial hearing in this case against Karen Reed was scheduled for April 12th. All the last-minute pretrial motions are filed, and this is the time when the attorneys go before the judge to make their arguments about what should and shouldn't be allowed in trial for the jury's consideration. Almost 40 motions were filed for consideration, some of them accompanied by some explosive arguments. The hearing was held on a Friday, and the following Monday was Patriots Day, a holiday observed in 6 states, but often most closely associated with Massachusetts. Patriots Day falls on the third Monday in April to commemorate the start of the American Revolution. And every year on this day, the Boston Red Sox have a game scheduled, the Boston Marathon is held, and the courts are closed. That means the final hearing, with almost 40 motions, was held on literally the last court day before trial begins. Some of the motions filed had no objections from the opposing counsel, so we were thankfully able to skip the arguments on those. Others, however, required both sides pleading their case to Judge Beverly Cannoni and led to some fireworks in the courtroom. I've gone over the arguments on the hair and the DNA testing extensively in previous episodes. In hearing after hearing, we've seen this issue come up repeatedly over the course of the last 2 years, and it's led to some passionate arguments in the courtroom and some heated arguments on social media. The defense filed a motion for sanctions and exclusion of evidence based on the Commonwealth's failure to timely comply with discovery orders. In the motion, the defense argues that the Commonwealth has failed to timely comply with numerous discovery orders imposed by the court and has not produced the results of any DNA testing of the purported hair by Bode Technology in spite of the impending trial date. The motion states, to allow the Commonwealth to introduce any findings by Bode Technology at this point would, therefore, unfairly prejudice the defendant by denying her the ability to make certain tactical decisions or have her own expert meaningfully evaluate any results. The filing lists case law that supports the argument that late disclosure can severely prejudice defense by forcing counsel to make difficult tactical decisions quickly in the heat of trial. The motion also argues the timeline of the hair, which is the main issue here. Although the hair was collected by a criminalist with the Massachusetts State Lab on February 1st of 2022, it sat untouched in police custody for more than a year. The visual examination was done on March 6th of 2023, though it turns out the criminalist who did the exam had failed her proficiency exam just a couple weeks before this. The root end of the hair was submitted for DNA testing to the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab in August of 2023, and the test results from August 25th forensically determined that no human DNA was detected. 3 weeks later, the Commonwealth requested exhaustive mitochondrial DNA testing, quote, with or without counsel for the defendant's signed approval, end quote. The defense, in turn, asked that they be allowed to have the hair examined by an independent lab before the mitochondrial testing, since that will destroy the sample. In November of 2023, the judge denied their request to be able to have their own testing done by an independent expert, and instead ordered the Massachusetts State Police Lab to send the hair to the Commonwealth's independent expert, Bode Technology. Lally was asked about the DNA testing from Bode on March 20th, March 26th, and April 4th, and each time he said that he did not yet have anything from them. On the April 4th hearing, when there was still no report from the lab, the judge said that she would entertain a motion to exclude. So that brings us to the argument now, where Judge Cannoni gives each side a chance to argue the motion and the response.
The motion regarding the DNA, regarding excluding the DNA.
Mr. Lally, why should I not allow that motion?
For a couple of reasons, Your Honor. Number one, what I can provide to the court by way of update is that most of the testing with regard to that item is complete. So first and foremost, the item is hair that was confirmed by the Bode testing prior to them conducting any sort of mitochondrial testing. the mitochondrial profile, the partial profile that was generated in regard to the hair sample is complete. The mitochondrial DNA profile in regard to Mr. O'Keefe's sample is complete. The preliminary analysis that I received by way of email from Bodie yesterday indicated that they were consistent with each other. I asked for some sort of preliminary report or something that I could share with counsel based on their lab's accreditation. That does not permit them to release anything by way of a report prior to it going through a full review process. My understanding is that not only that process, but the entire lab file should be produced by Tuesday. On top of that, what I would state as far as any sort of prejudice the defendant avers that they've suffered as a result of that, there is still zero reciprocal discovery that I've received in regard to anything from counsel. And then part of the delay, at least a portion of the delay in this specific testing, as the court is aware, as you've had a chance to review Bodie Technologies' observance policy as far as outside experts, there was a significant delay in hearing from counsel and for the defendant in regard to whether or not they wish to have someone present prior.
How long a delay?
I believe it was at least several weeks, if not a month. I mean, we spoke about it in person in December, and I don't believe that
my order was in November.
Correct. So when we received your order was in November. What took a little time on our part was to get the samples taken from the troopers in regard to the other testing, and in order to get all of those items shipped and transported from the MSPCL to Lorton, Virginia, to Bodie.
When was that done?
Late November.
Go ahead.
Then there was a evidence viewing, which both counsel attended. We spoke about it there. I think that was December 1st. And then I waited a few weeks, never heard back, followed up on it, and eventually heard back with regard to them not wishing to have anybody present for that.
When was that?
I don't have a specific date offhand, but
I need you to find it.
I can.
All right. So I didn't know that the defendant decided not to have somebody there.
Right.
And that prolonged it. They weren't able to go forward, right?
Yes.
The judge wants exact dates, so they take a brief recess and come back.
What are you handing me, Mr. Lally?
No, it's an email from Mr. Iannetti on December 22nd confirming that they do not wish to have observation for testing of the hair sample at Bodie.
All right, so that was about a month after my order?
Correct.
And the defendant's asking me to exclude this in part because of the late disclosure of the information.
Yes.
All right. I'll hear from the defense on this, and then I'll give you an opportunity to address it, Mr. Lally.
Defense attorney Elizabeth Little addresses the judge.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd first like to address the timeline that Mr. Lally has just explained to the court. First of all, we were not made aware that we were allowed to test based on Bodie's protocols and procedures until December 1st. We were given a letter saying it would cost $21,000 for our expert to sit in on that testing. We reviewed that letter. We told Mr. Lally that it was most likely we were not going to have someone independently watch the testing because of the price.
When was that?
December 1st.
When? December 1st?
On December 1st.
Okay.
We confirmed that in writing when he emailed us again on December 22nd. And I would note for the court that Bodie did not receive the hair from the Commonwealth until January 11th.
Okay.
So there was no delay on our part. As the court knows, to date we have received no reports from the Commonwealth regarding Bodie Technologies' analysis of the DNA. The Commonwealth has engaged in repeated and inexcusable delays regarding the testing of this particular item of evidence, which at this point is sanctionable. The hair has been in law enforcement custody for more than 2 years, Your Honor. It is now 4 days before trial, and we are told that we're going to receive this on the day trial is set to begin. There's no excuse for a two-year delay. We immediately conferred with counsel when he notified us as to what the requirements were going to be if we decided to have an expert present for testing. We got back to him the day that he emailed us following up about that, and they didn't even bother sending the hair to the lab until weeks later. So I don't think it's fair to blame the defense for a two-year delay in this regard. As the court may know from the notices of discovery, we've received an overwhelming amount of evidence. This week, last week, the week before that, we're on the eve of trial. It is not fair to throw at us yet another item of evidence that we have to retain an expert to assess. We have to review, we have to make tactical decisions. That's not a fair position to put the defense in. We've been asking for a continuance. I think the only fair thing, if the court is going to force us to go to trial, is to exclude this evidence.
Lally responds that he's not faulting counsel for the 2-year delay, but the couple of weeks that it took them to confirm about the observation is the significant delay that he mentioned. He goes on to say that he doesn't expect to introduce the reports in trial during the first week, or probably not even the first month. So he says that the defense can use that time to have their experts look at it. Now remember, the defense asked to have their experts look at it in September of last year before it was destroyed and they were denied. The judge says that she will take it under advisement and issue a ruling at a later date. Last week, with jury selection underway, the Commonwealth finally admitted a report from Bode Labs. At the time of this recording, the decision about whether or not the jury will be allowed to see it has still not been entered into the docket. Next up is the defendant's motion in limine to exclude irrelevant, inadmissible, and prejudicial prior bad character and propensity evidence. So a motion in limine is a legal request made before trial to exclude potentially inadmissible or highly prejudicial evidence. In this case, the defense is asking to exclude any reference to the, quote, irrelevant, inadmissible, and prejudicial events that purportedly transpired in Aruba, end quote. This was all on New Year's Eve, about a month before John's death. The defense argues that any probative value of the proffered evidence is outweighed by the risk of unfair prejudice. So what this means is that certain evidence can cause the jury to partially sympathize or discriminate against the defendant. For example, in the trial of Florida rapper YNW Melly, the judge ruled that the photos on his social media of him holding guns was not going to be permitted because it could potentially cause the jury to make a decision based on that rather than the evidence presented. So, what happened in Aruba? The defense says the Commonwealth wants to admit testimony about a completely, quote, irrelevant verbal argument, end quote, that apparently happened between Karen and a woman on the Commonwealth's witness list named Marietta Sullivan. The defense says that the sole purpose of this testimony is to try to assassinate Karen's character in the eyes of the grand jury. The filing states, quote, although every single witness unequivocally testified that there was no history of violence whatsoever in Ms. Reed and Mr. O'Keefe's relationship, during the course of the state grand jury proceedings, the Commonwealth repeatedly elicited inadmissible testimony regarding an incident that occurred in Aruba 1 month prior, which had no logical relationship to the crime charged. The Commonwealth has no reliable evidence to suggest that the Aruba incident had anything whatsoever to do with O'Keefe's death a full month later on January 29, 2022, or that this remote and isolated incident was even a point of contention in Ms. Reed and O'Keefe's relationship after that trip. During the course of the state grand jury proceedings, the Commonwealth called numerous witnesses to testify about this highly inflammatory incident, in which Ms. Reed apparently got angry at another woman, not the decedent, because she purportedly mistakenly believed that O'Keefe had kissed another girl. The Commonwealth intentionally admitted this prior bad acts and character evidence for no reason other than to sully Ms. Reed's character in the hopes that the jury would indict her based on the fact that she was, in Marietta's words, quote, an asshole, end quote. As set forth herein, this evidence must be excluded, end quote. The defense argues that Karen was mad at this lady, not John, because she thought that she kissed her boyfriend, and that has nothing to do with intent to murder John O'Keefe 1 month later. Judge Beverly Cannoni hears their arguments on this.
All of the witnesses who were present at the Waterfall Bar and Grill on January 29th, 2022, along with high-quality video surveillance footage from that night, established that Ms. Reed and Mr. O'Keefe were happy, they were in good spirits, they were getting along. There is no evidence to suggest that this incident had anything to do with the facts at issue in this case. The Commonwealth points to purported angry voicemails left on the decedent's voicemail to suggest that there was some sort of hostile relationship between Ms. Reed and Mr. O'Keefe that night. However, these voicemails were left after Ms. Reed dropped O'Keefe off at Brian Albert's residence and after he failed back to come back outside to meet her. There is no logical relationship between the prior bad acts evidence in this case that the Commonwealth seeks to admit and the crime charged here, and therefore this evidence must be excluded.
ADA Adam Lally responds.
Yes, Your Honor. So this also relates to Commonwealth's motion in limine number 20.
Yes.
So in regard to that, Your Honor, this is highly relevant evidence as it pertains to motive and as it pertains to the nature of the relationship between Mr. O'Keefe and Ms. Reed, which goes to motive, it goes to absence of accident, goes to motive, absence of mistake. And this is not a, as the defendant seems to continuously try to pose it as some sort of temporary or isolated incident. This isn't just the argument or the yelling of swears between the defendant and Ms. Sullivan in the lobby in Aruba. This then leads to an argument which both children indicate in their statements continued inside the room in front of them for about 20 minutes after it happened. This is also not a fleeting reference in the sense that the defendant continuously brings it up on her own, specifically in text communications with Mr. Higgins when she's talking about the nature of their relationship. And it's not just the voicemails that the defendant leaves on Mr. O'Keefe's phone after the murder occurs in front of 34 Fairview. It's also text messages exchanged between the two of them in the days leading up to that, in which they discuss the nature of their relationship. You also have statements from the children, which indicate that the victim had tried to break up with the defendant multiple times in front of them, asked her to leave the home, and she refused. You also have a text communication from Mr. O'Keefe to Ms. Reed in which he indicates that he thinks that their relationship is essentially...
What was the date of that one?
I believe that was the 28th. Then there's other text messages from the defendant to Mr. O'Keefe referring to their relationship between themselves and with the children as toxic. These are further statements regarding infidelity, which continue on to the morning of, in which statements that she makes in the backseat of the vehicle with Ms. McCabe and Ms. Roberts as they're looking for Mr. O'Keefe just prior to locating his body on the front lawn of 34 Fairview. These are statements regarding her belief of Mr. O'Keefe's infidelity that she repeats again when she's having her recorded interview with Ms. Voss from Boston Magazine. These are not isolated statements. These are not just one time 4 weeks prior. It's not too remote in time, and it does show sort of the nature of the relationship and as it's evolving over the course of that month from the date of the incident in Aruba all the way through until the date that Mr. O'Keefe is killed. In furtherance of that, also, there are statements that the defendant makes to paramedics when she's being treated on scene that the last time that she saw Mr. O'Keefe, they got into a fight or an argument, and she's upset because that's the last time that they spoke was during the course of a fight or an argument in front of the house on Fairview Road. So it literally continues from the Aruba incident all the way through to the murder's occurrence. So for those reasons, the Commonwealth would submit that it is relevant as to motive, it is relevant as to absence of accident, and it is relevant as to absence of mistake. Thank you.
So we've heard that they were happy and in good spirits that night, but an argument happened sometime later because she left him angry voicemails after she dropped him off. There had been some relationship issues recently, so the Commonwealth wants to admit the argument with Karen and Marietta from the month before as evidence of intent to kill John O'Keefe. We'll be right back. Next is the motion to exclude evidence regarding alleged harassment and/or intimidation of witnesses, aka the Turtle Boy stuff. Now, this was an interesting part of the hearing because both sides wanted to exclude this information, but the judge was like, I'm not so sure.
All right, so you were both in agreement on what's the defendant's motion to exclude irrelevant and prejudicial evidence regarding alleged harassment and or intimidation of a witness, and the Commonwealth's for different grounds and different scope, actually. Motion to exclude mention of Aiden Kearney, a.k.a. Turtle Boy, and his pending criminal charges for witness intimidation. So, though you both agree it's out, that doesn't necessarily mean that I agree with you that it should be out. I understand that the nature of the harassment, mindful of the grand jury minutes that I've read, that in response to some of the questions posed by those at the U.S. Attorney's Office, the answers explained away some conduct as a result of the extraordinary harassment witnesses were undergoing. So I'm not sure I agree with you. So go ahead and try and persuade me, but what I'm inclined to do is keep it out in the case in chief.
Defense Attorney David Iannetti argues that in order for evidence to come in, it has to be elicited by a party. So he asked the judge this.
So I guess the question that I would direct to the court is, do you intend to follow up with questions?
I'm not questioning the jury. It's clear that it may be a response, a natural response by a witness that neither one of you intended to get as a reason for something, right, that I'm not going to sanction the witness because I allowed the Commonwealth's motion.
The judge says that she's not going to tie the hands of witnesses to natural responses to questions. So neither side plans to introduce this into the case, but if they open the door, or if it's a natural response from a witness, then it comes in. Next up is the defendant's motion in limine to exclude serum, plasma, ethanol concentration, blood ethanol concentration conversion, and corresponding retrograde extrapolation analysis. Basically, the defense wants to exclude the estimate that was done to determine Karen's blood alcohol concentration level. They argue that the report from the Massachusetts State Police forensic scientist stated that the ethanol result used in the report was provided by an external party, and since they didn't do the testing themselves, the reports on the testing don't fall under the laboratory scope of accreditation. The defense also argues that since they can't establish that the blood test result that was administered is reliable for the purposes of a criminal prosecution, the result and the corresponding blood ethanol conversion and retrograde extrapolation that flow from the initial result should be excluded as unreliable. The blood work was done at Good Samaritan Medical Center when Karen was admitted after making statements about taking her own life after finding John dead. The hospital recorded the alcohol level in Karen, but the state police never applied for a warrant to test Karen themselves. They used the report from the hospital and did a conversion which gave an estimated range. They then used that conversion to conduct a retrograde extrapolation 2 months later. The report uses a time interval of 8.5 hours with an additional 2 hour allowance from the time of 12:45 a.m. So the report that the Massachusetts State Police say doesn't fall under their accreditation determines that Karen's blood alcohol content level could have been between 0.13% and 0.29% at 12:45 a.m. This is obviously a pretty big range, and the defense has a problem with it.
As it pertains to Mr. Roberts from the Office of Alcohol Testing's testimony regarding the serum conversion and the retrograde extrapolation, the reason for the range is because it's math and essentially taking into account a number of different variables. That is why the range is as it is.
Defense Attorney Alan Jackson states that the medical records hold a special place in the evidence code because they're not administered in anticipation of litigation. So they're considered non-testimonial when they're admitted with no cross-examination or questioning the experts behind the reports. Jackson says that the prosecution wants to enter these as medical records, but they're not. He says that since this was generated specifically in anticipation of litigation, they're considered ranked hearsay. He mentioned that there's a dash cam video of Officer Good telling Sergeant Lank that he's going to quote-unquote section Karen, placing a hold on her medically. He goes on to say that they can't validate the testing that was done or standardized protocols, so the extrapolation itself is invalid for trial. Lally argues that Roberts would come in and testify about his analysis, mathematical calculations, and results. He also says that the medical professionals who ordered and did the testing have received summons, and the defense is open to voir dire them or question them about their qualifications. The judge is going to also take this under advisement and make a ruling at a later time. Next up is the Commonwealth's motion to preclude reference to and redact the manner of death contained on the victim's death certificate. Now, we went over this last week, so I won't spend too much time going back over it, but the manner of death is listed as undetermined. ADA Lally argues that the manner of death listed for a death certificate in a medical context doesn't mean the same in a legal context, so he asks that it not be allowed. Attorney Elizabeth Little for the defense argues that the case law that was used in the prosecution's argument isn't stating that the manner of death undetermined be redacted, but rather the manners of death that were listed were homicide, suicide, or accident. And according to the Supreme Court, those are the ones that are better to exclude. The judge will take it under advisement. There's a motion by the Commonwealth to do Corey checks on jurors once they're seated. This is a criminal record check that returns information on available Massachusetts arraignments by submitting the name and date of birth. The defense opposes this, stating that jurors self-report and this is an invasion of privacy. He also says that in this case, the Commonwealth has sought to charge picketers and protesters in a very unusual manner, which he claims is harassing. And he states this is just another method of harassment and it's unfair. Judge Cannone allows the motion for Corey checks anyway. The Commonwealth also filed a motion to ask leading questions to the niece and nephew of Officer John O'Keefe. They're now 13 and 16 years old. This motion will be addressed in the future if there's any need. There's a motion by the Commonwealth requesting that their Cellebrite expert, Ian Whiffen, be able to do a demonstration in court of the time-stamped searches. The defense says that the demonstration will not replicate all factors that were present at the time, and the judge tells defense that she will give them time to have their expert look at the presentation that the Commonwealth provided and give a written response. There are motions about the communications between John and Karen and out-of-court statements that give insight into the victim's state of mind. Since these aren't specific, the defense will object to the statements as they come if they feel that they should. The Commonwealth also filed a motion to prevent any alleged bad character evidence or prior misconduct of the victim or any witness. Now, Attorney Alan Jackson says the information that they intend to question witnesses on is only for impeachment and to point out prior inconsistent statements. There are also motions to prohibit mentioning the FBI probe. Now, the Commonwealth argues that the FBI confirmed a specific person is not listed as the target. So he says that it's unfair prejudice if the defendant relies on the investigation of the FBI. Prosecution also claims that the defense shaped and influenced the federal investigation. The defense says the federal government is more than capable of making their own decisions and doing their own investigations. He also argues that there's a need to give proper context to the information presented to the jury and how it came to light. He points out that the feds are a neutral third-party agency and subject to a different level of scrutiny and weight of testimony from the jury. He also points out that the federal investigators were able to uncover evidence that the state investigators ignored. The judge later ruled that the attorneys can question about the date, when statements were made, and if they were under oath, and things like that, and they'll go into more detail about the stipulations later. The Commonwealth also asked to exclude the mention of the internal affairs investigation against lead investigator Trooper Proctor, as well as the case previously mentioned as it relates to Sergeant Link. The defense says that at this time, they're still receiving information about the internal affairs investigation against Trooper Proctor as recently as 24 hours before the hearing. Attorney Little argues that what they introduce with relevance to this case is going to depend on the testimony that's given, so I guess we'll have to see how that plays out in court. So now come two of the most explosive moments from the hearing. First, let's talk about a motion that was filed by the prosecution to admit evidence that the defendant was in custody for a period of time after her arrest. The indictment by the grand jury was in June of 2022. That's when Karen's charges were upgraded from manslaughter to second-degree murder. Lally said that during the booking process at Milton State Police Barracks, the troopers who conducted the arrest were wearing body-worn cameras, and he says that Karen gave a varying account of what happened.
So the substance of these particular statements is the defendant, Ms. Reed, continuously is told by Sergeant Buchanan to essentially stop talking. He's advised her over Miranda and advised her to stop making statements and repeatedly states that to her during the course of her making statements. But the sum and substance of it is she says something to the effect of, you know, are you in on the joke? And then makes some sort of reference to having witnessed Brian Albert and Colin Albert essentially smashed John O'Keefe's head into the taillight, indicating that that's how her taillight was broken. Doesn't make any sort of further statements about why she would then leave the scene after that occurred or anything like that. But these are, again, different accounts that have been made in direct variance to prior statements that she made January 29th to the troopers, to paramedics, to treating medical professionals, to Ms. Roberts, to Ms. McCabe, to the niece of Mr. O'Keefe, to a whole other sort of slew and variety of people with a different sort of variation on what transpired each time. So it's sort of inextricably intertwined with the fact that she's in custody.
So this was huge. Karen said that she saw Colin and Brian Albert smash John's head into her taillight. That's a whole different story than anything we've heard before. This was brought up in the morning hearing, and the judge asked Lally to get the video clip available to play when they come back at 2 p.m. Waiting to hear this video felt like it took forever. But finally, in the afternoon, the video was played.
Can you explain to me what the process is right now?
Absolutely. So you're going to be booked just like last time. Go through the same process. It's going to be a little less time-consuming. They're not going to do major case prints because we did those last time. We'll make a phone call. Your parents will be able to bring you whatever other additional need, things that you need.
Yeah.
And then tomorrow morning, you'll go and be arraigned at Norfolk Superior Court on the charges that were... I'm sure you'll go over the charges again when you're doing the warrant.
But I'm on bail, so how can I be spending the night here again?
Initially, your arrest was on probable cause out of the district court. Today, grand jury indicted you on these charges, which is second-degree murder, vehicle homicide, and leaving the scene of a death.
So bail doesn't apply anymore?
Typically, I'm not... So we don't set the bail. But typically, once murder comes into play, people are going to get bailed out.
So it's not manslaughter anymore. Is that the difference?
That's correct. It's a higher degree of taking a life. Okay, so that's the charges that you're being charged with now. And you were indicted by grand jury.
Okay, you're aware he was beaten up by Brian and Colin Albert. I mean, we're all in on the same joke, right? My taillight was cracked and John was pulverized.
Okay, you need to abide by the rights that were afforded to you, okay? So you can talk if you want. If you want to tell us what happened, that's fine. We'll listen, but you already knew your rights, okay? And I'm sure he's going to do it again. All right, if you want to talk to us, you want to give us a story, definitely.
If you didn't catch that, Karen said, you're aware he was beaten up by Brian and Colin Albert. I mean, we're all in on the same joke, right? My taillight is cracked and John is pulverized. Obviously, this statement is a lot different than what Lally said that we would hear in the video. The internet went wild that morning with people sharing his quote as proof of Karen's guilt. Hearing what was actually said, however, goes with the theory that the defense has been presenting all along. Now, like everything else in this case, the interpretation of Karen's words and behavior varied greatly depending on who was talking about it. Some people thought that she sounded too snarky and it came across as a bad look. Some people said that she was snarky because she was being accused of something that everybody knows she didn't do. The jury will have to decide what they think about it. Biggest moment of the hearing, right after this. That brings us to our final big moment, and definitely the most explosive moment, of the whole hearing. This is the argument for the defense to be able to present a third-party culpability defense, and also arguing a Bowden defense. Bowden defense is a defense based on the inadequacy of a police investigation. This is where a defendant can argue that deficiencies or omissions in the police investigation create reasonable doubt as to the defendant's guilt. Under the Bowden defense, if there is a potential third-party culprit that was known by police but never investigated, that may be admissible to prove that the police knew of a possible suspect and failed to take reasonable steps to investigate that suspect. Since these go hand in hand, they're being argued together.
I think a defendant in any criminal case has a much better shot, essentially, at getting evidence in regarding to Bowden as sort of a backdoor through, as to third-party culprit as sort of a backdoor through a Bowden defense. So what I'm primarily concerned with, Your Honor, is motion to eliminate number 30, because as the court is well aware, there have been a number of theories of speculation, rank speculation, opinions without any evidentiary support, names of certain people that have been dropped at this microphone by counsel at different pretrial hearings who are not witnesses, who have nothing to do with this case, who don't know anything about this case, who counsel, when they said those names and sort of dropped those, whatever they supported to be facts, knew that they had nothing to say and nothing to do with this case. What I'm concerned about is whatever is acceptable as far as believability when it comes to arguing things in pretrial motions, shouting things from courthouse steps, or bandying about on Twitter is not what we do here. And so now it is a time where counsel is going to be relegated to what is actual, admissible, relevant evidence. And what I'm asking for in this motion is for the defendant, through her counsel, to actually provide any admissible or relevant evidence that pertains to third-party culprit, which to this point they have not done.
Yannetti says that he will potentially bring in third-party culprit defense as the trial develops and evidence comes in. Lally argues that it has to be specific in order to meet the standard. He also says that he's not seeking to preclude Bowden defense, but he's looking for more information about what they're going to be bringing up and who they'll be bringing in. He said the reason he doesn't know this is because the defense hasn't given him any information. The defense isn't required to give the Commonwealth anything until the Certificate of Compliance has been met. The Certificate of Compliance marks when all discovery has been finished and given to the defense. This isn't usually done the day before trial. It's usually done much sooner, but Lally's been holding out for that Bodie Labs report. Yannetti has his chance to respond.
So the initial question is, why is there a third-party culprit defense? Why is it relevant? And we start, Your Honor, with the fact that our forensic medical examiner, Frank Sheridan, a pathologist, forensic pathologist, who has performed himself thousands and thousands of autopsies, has already submitted a sworn affidavit to this court that John O'Keefe's injuries are consistent with having been in a fight and are not consistent with having been hit by a car.
This is Lally's response to that.
Just first, again, what the case law requires is evidence and not just mere speculation, or saying that you have evidence is not actually evidence. I do find it somewhat interesting that Mr. Yannetti wrote apparently 4.5 pages of notes but didn't have time to write a motion to admit the evidence that he claims that he has. He references in regard to third-party culprit Dr. Sheridan, who indicated that the injuries are consistent with the fight. He's the same doctor who indicated that the injuries on Mr. O'Keefe's arm were consistent with the dog bite, which was then refuted by the DNA findings from UC Davis, as well as the fact that the injuries are only on one side of the arm. And last time I checked, dogs have teeth on the top and the bottom, and there's no injuries to the bottom of Mr. O'Keefe's arm.
They also disagree on whether or not John was hit by a car. Here's Yannetti.
FBI experts also corroborate that John O'Keefe's injuries are not consistent with having been hit by a car. They employed experts in biomechanics and kinematics who have reviewed the evidence in this case, and they've confirmed that the physical evidence essentially shows and doesn't show what Dr. Sheridan has opined. So therefore, If John O'Keefe was not hit by a car, that means that Karen Reed did not kill him. If he was not hit by a car, as both our expert and FBI confirmed, then he was attacked. And if he was not hit by a car, then there is a third-party culprit or culprits.
And no big surprise, Lally has a very different position on this. Here's Lally.
Counsel references the federal grand jury materials in which I would say, as has been done numerous times previously, is severely mischaracterized as to what they actually contain. And it's not a crash reconstructionist as it's been alleged here before. It's a biomechanical engineer. And essentially what they did was take painstaking lengths to determine that the defendant's vehicle did not strike Mr. O'Keefe in the back of the head, which is simply something that no one has ever said, intimated at any point ever. There is also a medical examiner in the federal materials who concurs completely with Dr. Scordibello's findings as it pertains to the cause and manner of death.
Dr. Scordibello is the doctor who said the cause of death was blunt impact injuries of the head and hypothermia, and the manner of death was undetermined. He mentions here that the FBI agrees with this, but I think it's worth noting that nobody has actually disagreed with this. The disagreement has come from what or who caused those injuries. Yannetti continues his argument to Judge Cannone.
You know, it is not our job to solve this case for the prosecution. It's our contention. They had the opportunity to do that, but they failed. It is not our job to name a specific third-party culprit. We do not have to prove that Brian Albert or Colin Albert or Brian Higgins or some combination of them intended to kill John O'Keefe. We don't have to prove that any of them attacked John O'Keefe such that he eventually died. They have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they didn't. But the fact of the matter is, there is evidence that all three of them had a motive, had the opportunity and the means. But in terms of being the right time period, Your Honor, you can't get any closer than their presence at the scene at the very time that John O'Keefe was killed. And in terms of the method of operation, given that we have evidence that he was not hit by a car and that he was attacked, all three of these men, either alone or in combination, possessed the ability to attack him with or without a weapon. I mean, that's a very low standard here. The Commonwealth acknowledges that. It's a low standard of simple relevance. And the evidence here establishes relevance. Now, I would note, Your Honor, the Commonwealth cites Commonwealth versus Finney. I don't know if they realize this, but that was my case. I represented Roland Douglas Finney before the Supreme Judicial Court, and I represented him at his motion for new trial and at his retrial. And that case, the Finney case, provides strong support for the introduction of third-party culprit evidence here, irrespective of a Bowdoin defense. In fact, the reason that Mr. Finney's conviction was overturned was that his trial counsel failed to pursue a third-party culprit defense. And, Your Honor, the third-party culprit defense in Finney was weaker, far weaker, than the third-party culprit defense we have here. But in Finney, the SJC ruled that not only was that enough for a defense attorney to present a third-party culprit defense, but he was ineffective for not doing so. Now, Your Honor, I could go through with the court the specific evidence we have with regard to motive, opportunity, and means with regard to the three Commonwealth witnesses that I've named.
So go ahead.
So the case law that Lally cited was actually one of Yannetti's cases. As Yannetti is making his argument, he says he could give the specifics of the evidence that they have in this case, and it's a lot more than what they had in the case that they're citing. The judge responds, go ahead. And that's when we hear all the new information.
Starting with Brian Higgins, he was present at 34 Fairview Road on January 28th to 29th. He was close friends with the homeowner, Brian Albert. He had a prior romantic interest in Karen Reed. He did not expect Karen and John O'Keefe to be at the waterfall, that bar, on January 28th. Karen Reed did not greet Higgins, despite the fact that they had previously exchanged flirtatious texts and that she had been at his apartment one evening, although there was nothing that took place between them any more than a peck of a kiss. At the waterfall, Higgins does not engage with John O'Keefe. He does not say goodbye to John O'Keefe and Karen when he leaves. But before he leaves, he texts Karen, and that text was something to the effect of, well, with a lot of M's. We know that there was a preservation order from this court, your predecessor, Judge Krupp, to preserve his cell phone, and that Trooper Proctor gave him an edict to order to serve on Brian Higgins, and he left it at the front desk of the Canton Police Station for him, and that Higgins, we learned through the federal investigation, Higgins became angry, demanded that Proctor come back, and he essentially upbraided him and read him the Riot Act, which shows a little bit about Higgins' personality. At the end of the night, everyone discussed going back to 34 Fairview, and when he gets back to 34 Fairview, he texts not Karen, he texts John O'Keefe at 12:20 a.m. He testified before the federal grand jury that he had no knowledge that they had been invited to 34 Fairview, but that is contradicted by this text message and the inference is that he was coaxing John to come to that house. And, you know, we're not saying this gives him a motive to kill John, but we don't have to show that. Any motive to feel hostility or animosity towards John O'Keefe goes to his motive. And, Your Honor, when Brian Higgins and Brian Albert are in that house, they're the only two people who are unaccounted for when the rest of the group was in the kitchen. And they claimed that they were looking at photographs together. And we have evidence that they were in the basement. We believe that Brian Albert made a mistake before the state grand jury by testifying they went upstairs to look at photos. Brian Higgins says unequivocally that the only place the two went was into the living room to look at photos, the military ribbons, whatever they were looking at. Brian Higgins did not know that Brian Albert had said they went upstairs. And he also testified he had never been upstairs at Brian Albert's house in his life. That means that if Brian Albert said they went upstairs, they're coming up from the basement. And before leaving 34 Fairview, Brian Higgins testified he was parked right in front of the mailbox. He would have had to have walked by where John O'Keefe's body was. His headlights, when he got in his vehicle, would have been illuminating where John O'Keefe's body would have been in the yard if it were actually there. So how does he not see it? He then goes back to the Canton Police Station at 1:30 in the morning after leaving 34 Fairview. He claimed to do some administrative work, but then he admitted to the federal grand jury that he was there to move his car because of the upcoming snowstorm. This suggests that he was fabricating a reason for going back to Canton Police to establish an alibi for himself. He was asked several times at the federal grand jury if he had any conversations with anyone before he went to bed, and when was he notified that John O'Keefe was dead. In the morning, he said. He testified under the pains and penalties of perjury that he had absolutely no contact with any person that night for any reason whatsoever. But he apparently was surprised that the federal authorities had subpoenaed his phone records, and he had to admit, and he did admit under oath, he made that 2:22 a.m. phone call around the same about 5 minutes before Jennifer McCabe is Googling how long to die in the cold, about 8 minutes before Brian Loughran, the plow driver, first drives by the house and sees nobody at all. And the next morning, Brian Higgins, the first person he spoke to was Brian Albert.
I'm going to stop you for a minute.
So the judge interrupts Unetti right here and says that the court reporter has been working hard, so they're going to give the court reporter a 5-minute break. We'll take this moment for a break, too. When they come back, Unetti continues his argument.
Your Honor, I left off with the morning of January 29th. The first person that Brian Higgins spoke to was Brian Albert. He had missed a call from Chief Kenneth Berkowitz earlier. Immediately after getting off the phone with Brian Albert, Brian Higgins drives back to 34 Fairview, where he has a meeting with just about all the witnesses in this case, Brian Albert, Julie Albert, Jennifer McCabe, Matthew McCabe. And immediately after that friends and family meeting, on his day off, which is a Saturday, he returns to the Canton Police Department, where he speaks with all of the first responding officers who had anything to do with this case. So this is a quote-unquote witness accessing and communicating with all the first responding officers, we would argue monitoring what they're doing in regard to the investigation. According to Brian Higgins, he admitted that Chief Berkowitz is one of his best friends, and that's why he had access to all these people. We have a law enforcement witness who will testify to seeing Chief Kenneth Berkowitz and Brian Higgins alone with Karen Reed's vehicle on the afternoon of January 29th of 2022 for, quote, a wildly long time.
So is this a name that's been in the materials? Is this a name known to the Commonwealth?
Yes.
Or is this somebody new? Okay.
We've now received video surveillance from the Canton Police Department that shows that there is an interior camera in the Sallyport garage where the car was housed. But during the exact time that third-party officer indicates that Berkowitz and Higgins were in the Sallyport together, the video mysteriously cuts out for 42 minutes. Between 5:08 and 5:50 p.m. And just to be clear here, we never get to see the condition of the taillight when it's brought into the garage. When we do see the car, we see it after Brian Higgins, Chief Berkowitz, Michael Proctor, and Yuri Buchnik have all had access to it. At 5:36 p.m., the car pings that it's arrived in the Sallyport. That's during the missing video.
You can hear the reaction in the courtroom when Unetti says that video footage is missing. This is now the third time that we've heard of video footage missing in this case. Could it really be missing? Here's Lally's response.
As far as the mysterious portion that's missing from the Sallyport, there's a number of different, it's a motion activated camera for the most part. The other thing that I would direct the court's attention to, as it was contained within the state grand jury proceedings, is cruiser camera video from the Canton Police cruisers. And what you can see within that cruiser camera video at 8:22 in the morning is the damage to the right rear taillight of the defendant's vehicle.
The camera in the Sallyport is motion activated, and that's why there's no footage. That makes sense. Until we look at the timeline and realize that the time that is reported to be missing includes the time that the car was taken inside. If the car is being moved inside, that's motion. So how would it not trigger motion activated cameras? This isn't like some little movement in the corner of the screen. This is a whole car. Unetti continues his argument about Brian Higgins.
Trooper Proctor, Trooper Buchnik never sees Brian Higgins' phone. They speak with him, and he takes it upon himself to use his own resources, Brian Higgins, within the federal government to ask a friend, Special Agent Mac Kelch, to download only the text messages in his phone between Karen and him and John. And that's it. We have to take his word for it that we got all of them, and we certainly don't have any communications between him and Brian Albert, for instance. On February 10th, when he shows up to his interview with Troopers Buchnik and Proctor, he brings with him copies of the text that he has deemed relevant in their murder investigation, and he hands them the copies of the extraction that he had his friend do. He then calls Matt Kelch the weekend of this incident to do the limited extraction. He never tells Trooper Buchnik or Trooper Proctor how he extracted the tests, despite the fact that it was done by a friend of his in the federal government. During the federal proffer, Brian Higgins admits that he had been served with a preservation order, and the Commonwealth told him he could destroy his phone despite the order. He then drives to a military base on Cape Cod, opens his phone, breaks the SIM card, and throws the phone away. And he says that he discussed destroying his phone with Brian Albert. Brian Albert also destroyed his phone. And Brian Albert said that he had received some text that concerns him as an explanation. And after that, Brian Higgins changes his phone number and changes his cell carrier. In short, he was present that night. He had a motive, and there is plenty of consciousness of guilt cover-up evidence with regard to Mr. Higgins.
This is a lot of new information, and it kind of gives us an idea of where the defense is going when they start presenting their case. You can hear the annoyance in Lally's voice as he responds.
In regard to Mr. Higgins, that was a fanciful story. But again, there's actually no actual evidence of most of those things, or at least the imputations or the connotations the counsel wants to put behind that. Whatever he feels things were observed. So again, I'm not sure where the evidence from this is coming from. What I'm also a little confused in regard to is that if counsel is merely relying on materials within the federal grand jury, and just learned of them at that same time as we learned of them when materials were provided pursuant to TUI, then it's a little peculiar that the exact same arguments were being made throughout the pendency of the case well before counsel was provided with any of those federal materials. What counsel just went through is essentially a list of rank speculation and not actual evidence.
Next, Yannetti addresses Colin Albert.
Moving on to Colin Albert. Shortly before January 29th of 2022, Colin Albert lived with his parents, Christopher Albert and Julie Albert, on John O'Keefe's street, just two doors down. We have evidence of bad blood between Colin Albert and John O'Keefe. We have evidence.
How old was Colin Albert at that time?
I believe he was 16 at that time.
Okay.
We have evidence that Colin Albert and John O'Keefe used to get in confrontations because Colin Albert used to cut through his yard without permission, and John O'Keefe was not happy about that. We have evidence that Colin Albert used to throw beer cans intentionally into John O'Keefe's bushes, and John O'Keefe was not happy about that. We have evidence that Christopher and Julie Albert knew of this conflict. We have evidence that they referred to John O'Keefe as Nebercracker. That's a character from a kid's movie, who was known as the get-off-my-lawn guy. When John O'Keefe and Karen Reed were vacationing in Aruba over New Year's Eve 2022, the Alberts, Christopher and Julie, taunted him. They went to his porch, and they had photos taken of themselves drinking on John's property when he wasn't there to do anything about it, evidencing they knew how upset he was at what Colin Albert had been doing. Now, the investigators in this case, Your Honor, including Michael Proctor, kept Colin Albert's name completely out of the police report. When this case began, I had no idea who Colin Albert was. I received a tip right from the jump that Brian Albert and his nephew had beaten up John O'Keefe. I didn't even know Brian Albert had a nephew at that time. But after receiving the tip, I learned of the conflict that Colin Albert had with John O'Keefe, so I sent a letter to Mr. Lally, I believe by certified mail. I knew that the DA's office was planning to present evidence or witnesses to a grand jury, and at that early juncture, before anybody had asked them to indict, I notified the DA of three potential suspects, the ones that I'm talking about now, Brian Higgins, Brian Albert, and Colin Albert. After he received that letter at our next court appearance, I'm sure Mr. Lally can confirm this, he acknowledged that both Brian Albert and Brian Higgins would be testifying or had testified before the grand jury, but he questioned why I included Colin Albert in my letter. He told me at the time that he had no evidence that Colin Albert was there that night. However, after receiving my letter, lo and behold, multiple witnesses testified that Colin Albert was at 34 Fairview the night of January 28th to 29th. And now the DA will argue, I'm sure, at trial, that he left before John O'Keefe arrived. We don't find their evidence compelling. We don't accept it. We are not required to accept their theory of the case. We're entitled to present a defense. His presence at 34 Fairview gave him the opportunity, along with the motive, to harm John O'Keefe.
Lally responds,
starting with Colin Albert, because that's frankly the easiest. He wasn't at the house, and that's what the federal materials confirm with each of every single of the witnesses that were spoken to by the district attorney's office or the troopers or testified at the state grand jury. They testified to the exact same things in the federal grand jury, that Colin Albert had left the house prior to the defendant and the victim arriving there, and there's absolutely nothing to combat that whatsoever, other than, again, just rank speculation. So opportunity would be a little bit amiss if he's not even there at the same time as Mr. O'Keefe, regardless of the invalidity of any sort of ill feelings or ongoing feud that's purported from whatever unknown evidence counsel claims to have.
Next topic of discussion, Brian Albert.
With regard to Brian Albert, Your Honor, this is a well-connected, well-known, powerful family in the town of Canton, Massachusetts. Brian Albert was present at that home when Colin Albert was there. Colin Albert is a member of the Albert family. He's nephew of Brian Albert. We have evidence that Brian Albert had expressed hostility toward John O'Keefe as well. And we know that he initiated a phone call with Brian Higgins at 2:22 in the morning. He reached out to Brian Higgins. And then he picked up the phone when Brian Higgins came back, and they spoke for 22 seconds. And they never revealed any of that to investigators. Again, consciousness of guilt. And perhaps most of all, Brian Albert is a first responder. He is duty-bound to help somebody who's in trouble. He was notified that John O'Keefe was in trouble. Brian Albert stayed in his home. He knew what was going on outside. His sister-in-law was out there, civilians, medical personnel eventually arrived. He did nothing.
So after all of this, now Yannetti makes his final plea for the Bowden defense.
With regard to the Bowden argument here, the police investigated none of that. That didn't come from the Commonwealth. They had a complete lack of curiosity as to what was going on in that house that night. They didn't care. Investigators never went in. The feds investigated, and that's where we got a majority of this evidence.
On the first day of jury selection, Judge Cannone addressed the decision that she had made for the third-party culprit defense.
Based on the offer of proof on Friday, I am well within my rights, pursuant to the case law, to exclude the third-party culprit defense. I'm not going to do that now. I'm going to give you a chance to develop it through relevant, competent, admissible evidence, but you cannot open on it. So that's my ruling on that.
So that's a fair ruling, and it's exactly what the defense had asked for. So that gets us just about up to speed. There are a couple of other interesting things going on surrounding this case that I wanted to bring up. There's a 200-foot buffer zone that has been placed around the courthouse. The Norfolk County District Attorney's Office asked the judge to enforce a 500-foot buffer zone around the courthouse complex. The judge said that she felt like 500 feet was excessive, so she instead decided on a 200-foot zone. She said in her pretrial order, "In this case, it is well documented that protesters have shouted at witnesses and confronted family members of the victim. Individuals have also taken to displaying materials which may or may not be introduced into evidence during trial, and airing their opinions as to the guilt or innocence of the defendant on their clothing or signage." End quote. The judge also ordered that there's to be no audio enhancing devices. So that means no like bullhorns or anything like that. And they're also not allowed to wear buttons, photographs, clothing, or insignia related to the case inside the courthouse. She also prohibited law enforcement officers attending the trial or testifying at it from wearing their uniforms. The buffer zone was appealed, but the Supreme Judicial Court Justice issued an opinion on April 12th stating that the buffer zone only minimally burdens petitioner's speech. The petitioners, along with the Freedom to Protest Coalition, filed an appeal to have the case heard by the full bench of the Supreme Judicial Court. There was also a motion filed by the defense that asked the judge to move the location of the jury box, arguing that some of the jurors wouldn't be able to see the faces of the witnesses when they are testifying. Now, the current setup, they say, violates Karen's constitutional right to confrontation because numerous members of the jury won't be able to see the faces of the witnesses who testify against her. Now, in this filing, they included photos of attorney David Unetti actually sitting in the witness box, and they took photos from different seats in the jurors box. I'm actually surprised that this courthouse has been around for 100 years and this hasn't come up before, because there are multiple seats where you only get kind of a partial view of the witness's face. The Commonwealth did respond to this and said that the courthouse has been set up like this for over 100 years, and it's also the largest courtroom in Norfolk County. But given the defendant's objection, the Commonwealth offered another alternative, that the trial be conducted in a different courtroom in the courthouse. At the end of the day on Monday, the number of seated jurors was up to 19. The original goal was to get 12 jurors and 4 alternates, so they actually have more than they were originally planning, but defense attorney Alan Jackson says that some of the jurors may have availability issues, so the selection process will continue and jury selection will resume on Wednesday. There was no jury selection held on Tuesday, but Aiden Carney, aka Turtle Boy, was back in court. Carney is in court for a hearing related to the 2023 and 2024 indictments for the allegations against witnesses. Special Prosecutor Kenneth Mello filed a motion seeking sanctions against defense attorney Timothy Bradle, who then filed a cross motion. Now, Mello was ordered by the court to respond to this cross motion by February 9th, so the judge asked if he had responded by that deadline since he said he hadn't seen anything. Mello said that he hasn't filed it because he has had medical issues prior to that date and is dealing with 4 separate medical issues at this time, but is recovering. Bradle said that this has been going on for months. He said that he usually doesn't have a problem with someone's health issues that they're claiming they have until today. Bradle said that Mello has had ample time to harass his client, but anytime something comes up where the Commonwealth has an obligation to provide discovery to illuminate these allegations, then there's a health problem. He goes on to say that the last hearing that was requested to be moved because of health issues, he said, yeah, no problem, just send the discovery that they're entitled to. He said that they've been given what he refers to as, quote, a big load of junk, unquote. He says he can't do anything with it. These are things like raw data that's useless to him, or files that don't have anything in it, or 5,000 pictures. He said that he's had to go through it with his paralegals and try to work to figure out what else he needs. Bradle says this is prejudicial and he wants to file a motion to dismiss. They need a grand jury to do that, so he said he needs to file a McCarthy and an Odell motion. And he says that they take things out of context and they take sarcasm or satire and they use it as threats. Mello responds and he says Bradle has all of the grand jury minutes and numerous discovery, and explains again that he's had health issues and he hasn't been in the office. The judge says that the defense is saying that they were not given the grand jury minutes. Based on Rule 14, which is a special requirement of prosecutor to provide information in a timely fashion, the judge has ruled that the grand jury minutes are to be given to the defense by May 8th. Mello says he'll send everything, and in an abundance of caution, he might even send things that they already have just to make sure that he gets everything to the defense. Bradle wasn't happy with this, and I'm going to play some clips because this got pretty heated.
Judge, I haven't seen an abundance of caution in this case. I've seen nothing but an abundance of delay and obfuscation whenever any obligation of the Commonwealth comes forward. I'm beginning to think that counsel here is so deficient in complying with these obligations. I think he's hired to do this, to delay, to to stop Mr. Carney from getting anywhere with this case, to keep him away from the Karen Reed case. And this is an intentional deprivation, Your Honor. Counsel said, oh, this isn't any intentional anything. That's not true, Your Honor. And let me tell you, the reason that I have a bit of a attitude about this discovery issues, which I can't remember ever having, Your Honor, in my 30 years. But here, Your Honor, I learned that the grand jury minutes were ready and were available by looking at the Karen Reed murder case discovery from that ADA, who provided, before I got them, my grand jury minutes were given to counsel for Ms. Reed. And that's why I learned that they were available and ready. And counsel here apparently gave them to Mr. Lally, the prosecutor there, who provided them to the Karen Reed defense team before I got them. That's how I learned of them. So if that's not a smoking gun that shows that counsel for the Commonwealth here is intentionally withholding documents from us, I don't know what is.
Mello didn't like this. Here's his response.
Your Honor, if I may just respond, not to say I resent, but I take some offense to the allegation that we're attempting to delay this. That's certainly not a marching order I've ever received. In fact, I've never received any direction whatsoever from the district attorney's office in the performance of my duties and my obligations. With respect to the grand jury minutes for one particular day, Judge, obviously that was an oversight. My understanding was when I was in the hospital, that was provided to Mr. Bradle. I can say that I haven't provided a single shred of information on any subject whatsoever, Your Honor, to Attorney Lally with respect to the Reed case. We have never exchanged one piece of information. I don't want there to be any allegations that we're conspiring with each other to move these cases together. Mr. Bradle may not accept.
And I'd like an explanation as to how my grand jury minutes got to the Karen Reed defense team before they got to me.
The judge tells both attorneys that he expects them both to follow rules of discovery and professional conduct in this case. I'll keep y'all updated. So that's it. This was a packed episode, but we had a lot to fit in before trial starts. Jury selection is expected to wrap up this week, and opening statements are expected to start next week. What questions would you need answered before you could consider Karen Reed guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? A medical examiner to explain the injuries? The Commonwealth's witness to make more sense than the defense's witness when explaining the 2:27 a.m. search? Jen McCabe's daughter testifying, it's not me or my sister with Proctor in that picture that everyone's arguing about? Or all of the above? More? Going into trial, I can't help but think of the explanation of that medical examiner's guide that I read last week, where they defined beyond a reasonable doubt as, quote-unquote, essentially 100% certain. Essentially 100% certain. Do you think that the Commonwealth has enough evidence ahead for a jury of her peers to be essentially 100% certain that Karen Reed is guilty? We're about to find out. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.